This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Republican leaders of the House are preparing for what they describe as a new order, a transformation of the governing process. My guest, George Will, is a conservative political analyst who now has the opportunity, for the first time in his career, to comment on a Republican Congress. Will is a regular panelist on ABC's Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated newspaper columnist and a columnist for Newsweek. His columns from the past 4 years are collected in his new book, The Leveling Wind. I asked Will how he interpreted the Republican victory in the House and Senate. Is it a vote for change that favored the Republicans this time around? Or is this a sign of a more dramatic move toward the right?
I think it's a particularly dramatic step in a 28-year march to the right so far. I think this movement to the right began with the 1966 elections, in which the Republicans gained, I think, 47 net seats in the House in reaction to the perceived disappointments and excesses of the Great Society. And the country's been steadily moving rightward ever since. The country today is much more conservative than when Reagan was elected, markedly more conservative even than 2 years ago when Clinton was elected. And I'm defining conservatism in a rough but useful index of hostility to government in general and the central government in particular.
What do you think, too, about the idea that people don't want government and don't want government to pay for programs, except for the programs that benefit me?
Well, that's the old argument, that the American people are ideologically conservative but operationally liberal. I do think we began to see in the last election a readiness on the part of people to say, of course I benefit from my representative in Washington looting and pillaging and from the public trough on my behalf, but there are 434 other congressmen doing that. And maybe we're all not net winners. Maybe we're net losers collectively as a result of this. There was one person in the 5th District of Washington State, the Foley District, it was quoted approximately as follows in the Washington Post. He said, yes, Foley's been a great man, and he's done wonderful things for this district. But anyone who can't, if someone by being so senior can bring so many millions of dollars back from Washington, Washington must be a corrupt place. So there's a deep ambivalence now about this interest group liberalism that we've been practicing for 30 or 40 years.
I want to ask you a question I've been asking other guests about the election, and that is, what do you think of the difference in the political style and the political priorities between Dole and Gingrich?
Well, it's going to be marvelous theater because Senator Dole is a senator. He's partakes of the somewhat more relaxed, somewhat more collegial atmosphere of the upper chamber. Senator Dole is a legislator, that is, a man who wants to make deals. He wants to move the machinery forward. He said on ABC on election night, when asked what he was going to say when he placed his post-election phone call to the president, Mr. Dole said, I'm going to tell him we Republicans don't want to be locked out of the process anymore. Now, that's a fairly modest complaint. Mr. Gingrich and the radicalized House Republicans want much more than to be at the table, to use another favorite phrase of Mr. Dole, much more than to keep the machinery ticking over and be part of the tick-tock of it all. These people have believed the government has been going in the wrong direction for a very long time, and they want to stop it in its tracks.
So what kind of theater do you think we'll be seeing?
Well, you're going to see tension between the more populist, more aggressive, less experienced House of Representatives and the more sedate upper chamber. The two bodies are now taking on somewhat the character that the founders envisioned, that the House would be a measure of the turbulence of opinion in the country, and the Senate would be a somewhat more stable body. Washington is said to have said, it's a little hard to track this down, that the Senate is the saucer into which we pour our coffee that it may cool. And a lot of stuff's going to get poured from the House into the Senate where it may cool, not to say congeal.
George Will is my guest, and he has a new collection of his pieces called The Leveling Wind. I'd like your assessment of how powerful the Christian right now is within the Republican Party.
It's a very strong, electorally effective minority. All three of those characteristics obtain, and it's the third that sometimes gets lost sight of. It is a minority. The Christian right is fairly strong, very strong in the South, somewhat strong in other states, but as the idea that it is the dominant force, a controlling force in the National Party, is just not true.
I guess as a political commentator, I'm curious whether you see yourself as being in alliance or in support of the Christian groups.
No, certainly not. I'm not a churchgoer. I'm just a walking around, fairly conservative American writer.
So is there something that troubles you about their agenda or their approach to promoting their agenda, or is it just a personal thing that you're not a churchgoer yourself, therefore you're not close to them?
I'm not close to them, and I'm not bothered by them particularly. It seems to me that this is a continental nation of 260, 70 million people. You're bound to have these interesting ginger groups and factions. And I think they give our politics weight, and they give it the dignity of ideas and convictions, and prevent it from becoming merely a maelstrom of economic interests.
How closely is Newt Gingrich connected politically with the religious right?
Well, I think very closely, because they have been very important in energizing particular constituencies in particular districts.
So what do you think that means in terms of power sharing in the next few years?
Nothing much. The Tom Kaine, the former governor of New Jersey, a moderate Republican by anyone's understanding, was for a while somewhat alarmed by the religious right. And then he went and met with leaders of the religious right and came away saying, you know, these are just sort of normal, fairly conservative Americans, but with a basically mainstream agenda. They want welfare reform, they want smaller government, they want less intrusive government, they like balanced budgets and all the rest. The idea that abortion characterizes the religious right. It may characterize some of their strongest feelings, but it will not characterize the effect they have on our politics, because remember, when the Republicans controlled the Senate for 6 years in the 1980s, that Senate did not even bring to a vote a constitutional amendment on abortion. There wasn't, I believe, a vote on a voluntary, so-called voluntary prayer in school amendment. It is to me, astonishing that people run for governor or even for alderman in this country taking positions on abortion when everyone knows that the Supreme Court is not going to repeal Roe v. Wade. Furthermore, should Roe v. Wade be overthrown, which it will not be, there probably isn't a state in the Union that would seriously impede first trimester abortions, which are 95% of abortions. This issue is settled. The culture has moved. And a consensus has emerged, a majority consensus, granted with a vocal and unreconciled minority in the country, a consensus has emerged in favor of liberal abortion policies. People can relax.
Let me ask you about something that confuses me. I think that you feel that government should play a fairly minimal role in the lives of individuals in America. And yet, you know, the Christian groups seem to have chosen as their primary issues that most people would consider to be pretty personal: sexual orientation, abortion, which you've addressed, you know, the whole family agenda. And so you could surely argue that this part of the right in America is really making more of an argument that government should be involved in personal lives.
Well, there's no question that some factions of the conservative movement are more libertarian than others. On the other hand, we have to be careful when we talk about, say, some conservatives having anxieties about homosexual lifestyle and all the rest. The question there is not always, in fact, is rarely, that the religious right or conservatives want punitive legislation. Generally, what they are responding to are what they consider provocations, and they're responding in defensive ways. For example, when some of the people of Queens, the borough of Queens in New York City, rose up, they did not rise up in hostility, sort of unprovoked hostility to homosexuals. They rose up against a school board that they felt was mandating a particular propaganda in their classrooms. This, you remember the issue about the the curriculum that had books, Heather Has Two Mommies and all the rest.
Yeah, it was called the Rainbow Curriculum.
That's right. And they felt that they were being provoked and were acting defensively. So it doesn't seem to me that it's fair or accurate to suggest that the religious right or anyone else on the right is marauding around looking for ways to be aggressive against other people. They want left alone.
My guest is syndicated columnist George Will. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Will. His new book is a collection of columns called The Leveling Wind. A word that is often used in describing Newt Gingrich is bomb thrower. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not, but I'm wondering, as a student of the American political process, what you think of his approach to legislating, if you think that it's good to have somebody who's more on an extreme end like that within the political process, or if you think he doesn't have sufficient respect for the give and take of the political process.
Well, let's wait and see. First of all, he had no chance to legislate because he has been living in a house run with increasing authoritarian sternness by the Democrats over the last decade. As recently as, say, 1978-79, about 70% of the measures that came to the floor of the House came under what are called open rules. That is, they could be amended by the minority. The minority could at least propose amendments. In the final years of the Foley-Gephardt dictatorship, and I don't use that casually, most legislation came to the floor under closed rules. The Democrats have run the House in an authoritarian manner, so we don't know what the Republicans will do as legislators. But what we do know is they won't abuse power any more than the Democrats have done. Indeed, one of the pledges the Republicans have made is that they will not turn around and inflict on the Democrats the kind of authoritarian regime that the Democrats imposed on the Republicans in the House. When you say Mr. Gingrich is an extremist, I think you and I may differ as to where the American center is now. Mr. Gingrich is a lot closer to the American center than, say, Mr. Gephardt is.
How much follow-through do you expect on the contract with America?
Lots. I think the Republicans said, pin it on your refrigerator, and if we don't follow through, throw us out.
Crime figures into the contract with America. The emphasis is on cutting social spending from this summer's crime bill and to build more prisons and to add more law enforcement. I don't believe the contract says anything about addressing the causes of crime, does it?
Well, it depends on what you think the causes of crime are. The basic causes of crime are young men age 14 to 21 or 22. You can cast your description of the cause of crime in a variety of ways. If you assume that, say, poverty is the cause of crime, then you can say the Republicans are not serious about fighting the causes of crime. But since most poor people are not criminals, it's not clear in what sense poverty is the cause of crime. So what I think Republicans and conservatives generally are saying is, we don't know quite what causes crime. We certainly don't know how to engineer society in a way that will produce non-criminal behavior at all times and all places. Therefore, what we can do in the way of fighting crime is to catch people, convict them in a speedy way, and incarcerate them in a serious way.
There was an article in the Sunday Times about growth in crime and a lot about the demography. Apparently, demographers are predicting a big crime rave.
Absolutely.
Shortly after the turn of the century, because there'll be so many young teenagers.
You can see the bulge of young men.
So this is a quote from Alan Fox, the dean of the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University. He said, to prevent a bloodbath in the year 2005, when we will have a flood of 15-year-olds, we have to do something today with 5-year-olds. But when push comes to shove, prevention programs often fall by the wayside in favor of increased incarceration. I think one of the things he might be referring to there is the contract's proposal that single mothers who are, I think it's just basically single teenage mothers, won't get any form of welfare benefits, and if there's a problem, their children will be sent to orphanages. I know Newt Gingrich has proposed that.
Well, the orphanages are not in the Republican contract, but various Republicans have talked about this, but so have people who are independents and extremely distinguished academics and scholars such as James Q. Wilson has talked about this possibility. Perhaps Professor Fox at Northeastern knows what social programs can be designed that will work to prevent crime. If so, he ought to get on the metro liner and get down here and tell people, because down here in Washington, people are a lot less confident than Professor Fox seems to be about our knowledge of how to prevent crime. It is the case that there is now underway a fundamental questioning of the welfare state, and it is related to the question of illegitimacy. In 1963 and 4, when young Pat Moynihan, then of the Kennedy and Johnson Labor Departments, published his report on the crisis of the black family, at a time when 26% of all black children were born to single women, Pat wrote an article in which he said approximately the following. He said, "The lesson of history is clear. From the wild Irish slums of the 19th century to South Central Los Angeles today, when you have a large cohort of essentially unparented adolescent males, you have chaos. Today we have chaos in parts of our cities where life is a slow-motion riot, precisely because in many central cities, 80% of the children born are born to unwed mothers. Now that is going to be a crisis wherever it happens. And the argument is that the welfare state's growth has not only coincided with, but may be causally related to, this explosion of social pathology since the late 1960s and early 70s, the worst of which is illegitimacy. So, the argument goes, we have to now consider whether or not the government is actually doing harm in the name of doing good, whether or not it is a kindness that kills. And the argument, put most crudely, is when you subsidize something, be it wheat or illegitimacy, you get more of it, and that we are, with generosity toward unwed mothers, we are subsidizing illegitimacy and getting more of it, and in the train of that development, more crime.
You know, conservatives would say that it's our programs that have been responsible in part for the growing level of crime, and then liberals would argue, but since 1980, there's been cutbacks in those programs and crime's been going up, so you can't exactly blame those programs for what's been happening because the crime's been on the rise since the Reagan years. So give me your argument.
But throughout the 1980s, the government subventions for unmarried mothers have been much more generous throughout the 1980s than they were under, say, President Kennedy in the 1960s.
As a conservative, do you feel that you play a slightly different role in your country's politics when you're criticizing Democrats as opposed to when you're criticizing Republicans or fellow conservatives?
No, I don't think so. In fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book on term limits was because I've come to believe strongly that we have a political class. And by class, I mean a group of Republicans and Democrats alike who are more united by interests and patterns of behavior than they are divided by ideas. Now, that may be changing a bit as we become more ideological, but basically, journalism is not romance. Journalism is writing about, in a fairly cold-eyed way, about fallible human beings in positions of constant temptation, which power is. So it's not as though Republicans win a majority in Congress and a bright new dawn breaks.
Did you ever want to go into politics yourself?
No, not really.
You started off, though, working in a legislator's office, didn't you?
I did. I worked on Capitol Hill for 3 years, had a wonderful time, learned a lot. But in the first place, writing for me is a metabolic necessity. I'd explode if I didn't do it. So I want to continue doing that. Second, I'm quite clear in my own mind that the great pleasures of life are in private life, children, families, all that stuff.
Would you feel that politics interferes too much with that private side of life?
Oh, absolutely. The dirty little secret, and indeed it's less and less of a secret, is that electoral politics swallows the life and requires a distortion of life in a way that is extremely painful and costly to families.
It's an interesting point, and I wonder if you think that that is affecting those who do I mean, weeding out some people from ever entering the political process they fear that.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. That combined, not just all I've spoken about so far, is the devouring demands on time. There also is the relentless and now limitless assault on privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take those two, and obviously a great many good men and women say, what's the point? Indeed, it has been said that anyone who will do what it is necessary to do to become president is thereby disqualified from being president. That's exactly the kind of person you don't want out there. Someone driven, obsessed, monomaniacal, and willing to sacrifice the interests of those nearest and dearest to him.
This is a pretty major problem, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I should say so.
So how does a country go about fixing something like that?
Well, they all rush out and buy Will's earlier book on term limits. And they become convinced that one way you do that is by ending careerism in politics. You make politics an episode in a mature, normal life.
I've got one last question for you. How did you survive this fall without the World Series?
Alarmingly well. If I were the owners, I would take cognizance of just how many people there are like me, who found that baseball is a habit. It's not like football. Football's a spectacle. Baseball's a daily habit. And the thing about habits is you can break them. And a lot of us have broken our baseball habits. And whether or not we'll ever get them back is a contingent question.
It sounds like a warning.
It's a shot across their bow, yes.
George Will, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
George Will has a new book that collects his columns from the past 4 years. It's called The Leveling Wind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.